You're listening to a nerdy production.
Warning, this is a nerdy production.
Welcome to the GM Workshop. We want to dive into insight and tricks from game masters and game designers all over the world and digging up that tacit knowledge so we all can be better game masters and evolve the hobby we love so much. Reach out to us on the GM Workshop at Facebook, Twitter, and Discord, and subscribe to the podcast in any podcast app you are using. And now, on to today's episode. Welcome to the GM Workshop, and to Athos, and to Darkson. Today's episode is about Darkson, of course, and the episode is constructed a bit different than normal, because I have talked to three wonderful GMs and game writers for Darkson, and they give us some different perspective on why Darkson are great for them and why we should play it. I'm about to figure out how to write a version for Darkson with the Forbidden Lands rules from Free League. So it was imperative for me to dive into some knowledge about the setting and why it's so great. I love Darkson. I've played it a lot. I played it in 2nd edition and some in 3rd edition and in 5th edition. But I always miss that opportunity to dive into Darkson as a nitty-gritty way and really feel like the players and the world and setting was confined into that horrific and brutal world we have in front of us. So hope you will join us in a talk about Darkson. The three people I have invited inside the GM Workshop for today is Chris, which has always played Darkson since the early 90s in 2nd edition, and he writes a lot about Ravenloft and other D&D settings. I have Jack, which just has released a book on Darkson, and it's about the Deadlands, and you can dive into that in the show notes. The final guy I've talked to is Jason, which has a lot of insights in 3.5 and a lot of other D&D settings. So there's a lot of different perspectives and a lot of different nerdy stuff about Athos and all the great stuff in that setting. One of my big beefs with Darkson is Dungeons & Dragons. And Dungeons & Dragons are heroic fantasy, mag fantasy, a lot of spells, a lot of classes, a lot of abilities. And the nitty-gritty things about Darkson are not that for me. But my three guests have some perspective on why D&D was their choices and why they played with D&D. So that was the main reason for this dive in with the three guys. So let's see what we talked about in those segments. Jack, give us his perspective on magic and the system-wise things in the choices he makes when he DMs Darkson. Now, when we look at Darkson as a whole, it's a high fantasy world, actually. There's a lot of races, there are a lot of weird stuff in it, there are a lot of monsters. It's not Denmark 2022. There's a lot of weird places, yeah. And so the players has to buy in on the fantasy mode, but if you take out a D&D player, a classic D&D player, he knows that there are monsters, there are weird stuff, and so on. But then we look at the settings, difficulties for a player, because this setting is for hard mode, as we talked about before, because you are constricted about spells. There are weird monsters that you don't know as a player, because it's a whole different way to look at races. The classic races are turned upside down, and magic are constricted, that we have no food, create food and water things are,
yeah, well, that they're shriveled to a shadow what they would normally be.
Yes, for sure. And we have the defiler concept and the preserver concept, so there's a different view at magic. Magic users are hated by the normal people, or the mugglers, if you use a Harry Potter term.
Yes.
And most people cannot see the difference between a cleric, a druid, or a defiler. So if you can conjure up stuff, if you can do magic, you are a magic user, and therefore you are bad. So you are confining your players to not use that much magic because of the social circumstances in the setting, and I love that so much, and I'm using that a lot in other fantasy settings. So how do you help the players and find the notches for high fantasy in a low magic setting? How can you guide the players into this and game masters if they want to pick up the Dark Sun?
It's an interesting take, and it's a nice antidote to the high magic setting, because you can play Dark Sun like that, and it's an interesting experience to where it does almost become like I'm trying to think of an example of you do see this occasionally in movies, like somebody who's sort of alone and stranded in the desert, like one of these survival movies. Where then the focus of the campaign then becomes about simple survival. It then becomes about sort of the hard practical, facing the hard practicality. It's not man versus monster; it's man versus environment.
Yeah, that's one of the paradoxes in Dark Sun, because you have a high fantasy world, you have monsters, you have weird races, you have magic items, dragon kings, and so on. So there's a lot of high fantasy elements, but the magic setting, the magic are so constricted by the players, and as you said, the Langmoor setting has that going for it, that it's mostly humans, right? If I remember correct, yeah. So the leap of fate into the supernatural are a bit harder for those characters, but in the Dark Sun setting, the leap of fate are not very difficult, because they know these things exists. They can see it every day, but they are not allowed to use it. How do you help, especially new players that come from, example, a classic Forgotten Realms setting, and into Dark Sun? How do you help GMs to guide their players into that mindset?
Well, from my experience previously running this game, it was never an issue. And the reason why I say that is because, like in some of the early adventures, like say the first module, Freedom, and the sequel, Road to Uruk, the players, you could use whatever magic or psionics you want for all the good it would do you. I mean, it's like you simply don't have the resources to do anything big. You don't have the power and what powers you do have, their application, their scope is actually so small that. That you're still left back in the survival element anyway. Okay, yes, you can cast Create Food or Water, that might slow down your dehydration for a couple days, but it's not going to solve it. You might be able to use psionic telekinesis to actually punch someone in the head. Great, try that on your slave master, see what happens.
Yeah.
Or if you can cast a magic missile. Yeah, let's see how long you last in the arena with that. The tools are there, but what you're up against. And that's one of the interesting things about Dark Sun, is that evil is already almost triumphed, and so actually struggling against that, it's not enough to have power. You got to be clever about it. You got to be, and also even perhaps a little bit lucky.
For sure, it's a great point to see that this mystic system, the powers that players can achieve through their classes and so on, they are not the players in this setting. Are not the most powerful characters.
So that's what makes it so interesting. Is that you're forced to work. You're forced to find other ways around your problem. Like the book I've just recently released, Secrets of the Deadlands. This is an old book that was supposed to have been done in the final days of TSR, but then it got shelved. And it's been about 20 years, but we've actually finally managed to get it done through all different types of teams dropping out with it. But we got it done. But what's interesting about it, it is the darkest of all dark settings. So it's an entire land of the undead south of the Tablelands. And if you try and go into this land, I mean, there's an introductory adventure that comes with it called The Emissary that we just released as well. This adventure in this land is literally a death trap for murder hobos. You do not have a prayer. If your first instinct is roll for initiative, you do not have a prayer. There is no way of completing this adventure with conventional hack and slash without expecting to survive. It's just written into the setting. It's like even if you're a 20th level mage, you don't have a prayer if you're gonna pick a fight with some of these big boys.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah. It's cool to have that in the narrative, and as all Dark Sun I always played, as you said, murder hobos are not well suited for this world, for sure. But and as you said, in the Undead Lands, as you created, you've written up, it's more vivid for sure.
It's writ large. And that's one of the reasons why it was so important when we actually wrote this book, that we made sure that it's not enough to actually say, okay, this is the Endless Legions, the undead. No, these characters had personalities, they had culture, they had history. And so once you understand kind of what this particular NPC wants, no matter how evil or monstrous they are, that kernel of motivation, that kernel of humanity, gives you a point of interaction, and you may find yourself actually running a quest for the most monstrous killer in the Deadlands, haunting the Forbidden Mountains. There's a character in there called the Nameless Shaman, and yes, by default he kills anything that comes into his lands. But if you know how to approach him, if you know what his history is, if you know what he's angry about, you can interact with him. And you can actually do things for him, which would change the entire dynamic of the conversation, change the entire dynamic of the Deadlands.
System-wise, Chris has dedicated himself to second edition, and therefore he has some great perspective on why the system is great for Dark Sun. The different races are so cool. I love the alternative race configurations in Dark Sun, the tall elf and the cannibalistic halflings and so on. They have turned some of the tropes on their heads, and it's so important for me to emphasize that Dark Sun is much more than a setting. It's another way to play Dungeons & Dragons or
exactly.
play role playing. It's Mad Max. Yeah. It's the world is dead. We cannot fix it.
People are going to be mean to you there.
Yes,
you just got to get over that. It's not a place that you can sit down and suck your thumb and take a minute to get over it, because if you do, something's going to come up behind you and get you by the back of the neck and break your neck and drag you under the sand.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And it's not Mac Fantasy, and that's the most important part for me. It's the only setting, maybe beside Ravenloft, that I would play as a Dungeons & Dragons setting. Because it's such evocative, as you said, the art and the feeling in the setting is giving us a lot of tools for GMing. The gritty, I love gritty fantasy also in other settings, like Warhammer Roleplay is also pretty gritty. It can't be pretty gritty, and it's the realism is where I really want to put in the foot and try to underline that this setting is so great. The realism.
Yeah, that's one thing that I really really like about it is you actually have to keep track of crap. People don't like that. But it's like, well, you know, if you didn't prepare, it's not my fault you ran out of water, or that you didn't have enough, you didn't think to go around and try to collect your crossbow quarrels after a battle, you know. Or if you had to run off, well, crap, now you'd better think twice about engaging somebody, you know, because you don't have, your only ranged weapon's that crossbow, and you've only got three quarrels now, you know. So, but yeah, one of the things that I do to help make it feel gritty, I don't know if I'm jumping the gun to another question or not, is it seems this is something that has through the years become more common, is just letting anybody pick up a character where a new character kind of where the old one left off. If you've not got your, I allow the character tree, but otherwise your character starts at starting level. That makes death actually something that the players then don't want to happen, so that makes them really consider it. It's not just like, oh, this guy's just a name and some hit points and a couple of stats on a sheet. Who cares if I run in there and give it my all? But, you know, if you're starting over with a new character from the beginning, then if somebody decides to make that sacrifice, it actually means something. You know, somebody's like, you know, you guys leave, I'll hold them off, kind of thing, or whatever. You know, that actually makes the sacrifice mean something, because like you said in the term you use with McFantasy. Yeah, it's like, who cares? I mean, you're gonna all you got to do is sit down for an hour and you get most of it back anyway. You sit down for 8 hours and you're pretty much fully healed. You've got the healing power of Wolverine, or you're not actually getting hit. You know, you're just getting tired from almost being hit and ducking out of the way. You know, that whole idea of hit points is so, I don't know. I won't say anything bad about it, I guess, because I don't want to get into an edition war or anything, because how other people want to have their fun is just fine. You know, just because it's not for me doesn't mean that it's not good. You know, that it's not a perfectly acceptable way to have your fun, you know. Like you said, Dark Sun, they really took it a whole nother direction. I mean, even in just the first box set, there was a 96-page book that was, this is how it's different than standard AD&D second edition. This is all the stuff, you know, the races, the classes, the proficiencies, the spells, how they work different, the stuff that's not here, the stuff that is here.
It's some of my beefs with the Dungeons & Dragons systems in as a whole since second edition. I played a lot of second edition and a lot of third edition and not as much fourth edition and some fifth edition. But the biggest beef for me system-wise and why I don't like it for gritty games is the hit point parameters, and they are just weird for me to not pressure my players and hit point wise. But that's a system discussion, not a Dark Sun discussion for sure.
Yeah. Well, primarily, let's see what there's no paladins from, and that's really the only one that they got rid of from the player's handbook. But they picked up a couple too, you know, like they replaced Paladin with Gladiator, which is a whole lot more evocative of the setting. So not that I would play it that way, but I have looked at a lot just so that I can say that I'm not just judging them without having looked at them. And most of the fifth edition conversions I have seen, as I said in the video that I made about whether fifth edition is proper for or can be used to run a proper Dark Sun game, they smack of somebody not really knowing the setting all that well.
It's eternal talk about the fifth edition because it's the most popular version of D&D, and Jason backs me up in this relations as in Chris argument that 5e is too heroic for Dark Sun as a setting. The low magic and in the high fantasy world, it's some choices they made in the setting, also the special races and the social structures for most cases. Mm-hmm. Can we put in why Dark Sun is special for you, but also in experience for D&D players as a whole? Because I know there has been a lot of tries to have some third-party releases on 5th edition on this, and it's I've tried some of them, but they were terrible.
And they've all failed.
Yeah. Because we have a low fantasy, we have a high fantasy world, but they are very much low magic in most cases. They are silencists, and the wizards are very pressured. There are no sorcerers.
Yep, nor warlocks, and the clerics are elemental.
Yeah. Right. So they are very confined, and they have very strict boundaries on how to create, not to go into so much of a rules thing or right. system thing.
It's very limited.
And how do you put this into a setting for players? And why do you think these choices are great in this setting?
Okay, so I would say, for most D&D players, right, so they're coming with some experience in already playing Dungeons & Dragons games, Dark Sun is a shock. It's like jumping into cold water. It's a shock. Your whole body is like uncomfortable. This isn't right. So, it's not just low magic. It's low wealth.
Low resources.
Right? Your players are not decked out in really high-end gear. You'll be lucky if you get like one high-end piece of gear at some point and you're able to hold on to it, because everyone else is going to be gunning for it. It's that whole hoarding bread kind of thing again, right? So the interesting piece about Dark Sun, because you take low wealth and low magic, and then you put them into a high fantasy world, you immediately think, like, there's no way you can survive,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, it's a high fantasy world. You've got monsters, you've got the elemental drakes, you've got all of these things that are just killer, and your PCs are not as powerful as you're used to seeing them in other D&D games. So this is where psionics comes into play, and it's both a blessing and a curse at the same time. So everything in the world gets this twist of psionics. And that's the curse part. So you're walking, decided to leave the city state, right? You're an escaped slave, and you're out in the wilderness, and you see a plant, and you think, oh, it's green. I can probably try and eat it. And even if I can't, maybe it's got some water, like a cactus, or I can dig underneath its roots and see where it's getting its water from. And as you get closer to it, the plant psionically assaults your mind. Right? That's just not something players are used to seeing. Everything in the world has evolved psionically to become more dangerous to kill you. At the same time, so has humanity, so has all of the rebirth races. Dark Sun people will get the note there on what that means. So all of the PC races just inherently have some minor psionic potential. Now, it's not universal, but in most campaigns, the PCs basically get a free psionic power and a couple of power points in order to use it. NPCs, maybe 10% have them. Typically, your important ones may have one, but not necessarily. So about 10% of the population is psionic, which is interesting, especially if you're in the trade of keeping slaves. 1 out of 10 of your slaves has some sort of psionic ability, and you have no idea what it is. So maybe they can... sneeze acid, which is going to really ruin the gates that you've thought are going to keep them penned up. Or maybe they'll have some other ability.
Oh, mind control.
Right. Yeah, right? Then who's the slave? If the slave's got mind control. So, I would say the psionics creates this this middle ground that allows you to step between the low magic, low wealth, and the high fantasy world. The part about... psionic specific to Dark Sun for D&D players is Dark Sun changes everything about arcane magic and divine magic in the first place. So already you're walking into the setting and all right, you're like a land lover going onto a ship for the first time and you just don't have your sea legs. It takes a few sessions to get your Dark Sun legs underneath you. Right, so all arcane magic is destroying or making use of plant life around you. Some of it will even make use of living sentient beings' life or animal life. All of your divine magic is linked to the elemental planes and not to deities. No gods, right? There's no gods in Dark Sun. That is one of the big shining aspects of the Dark Sun game is there's no deities to deal with here. All you have is the elements. You have the sorcerer monarchs if you're a Templar, and you've got a spirit of the earth, which is a limited area of nature that has a guardian spirit watching over it. And those are really your only choices for divine magic. And then on top of all of this, you have psionics, which in the original setting never meshed with either the arcane or the divine magic inherently. Later on, we learned that you can combine the two and become a dragon or an elemental or what have you. But if you're a wizard and you put up a sphere that blocks all magic between first level and third level, that's going to protect you from arcane magic. That's going to protect you from divine magic. That's not going to protect you from anything in psionics. Similarly, if you've got psionic defenses up, which all psionicists have some sort of psionic defense there, that's not going to help you when a cleric starts casting a spell at you or a wizard is going to throw a fireball at you. So it's another source of power but it just doesn't play well with the others. They're not not nice.
In most cases, I think Psyonix, especially in second edition, that it was a mess. Rule wise, it's
it wasn't well tested.
It wasn't great, and they put it into Dark Sun like a fluke, I think, and it was it was just shoved in
basically. There, like you said, a lot of people have tried to create a Psyonix, third party rule set to incorporate into fifth, and just so far, none of them have really worked out.
The one that I tried, actually, I have the Trikeen Psynicist with me as a player, and that Psynicist rules was actually okay. It was okay. Pretty toned down.
Nice.
He was fine. We had a cleric with us, and they were that similar power level as like a caster levels, right? For most cases, and he had a bit fewer choices, but were a bit more powerful. And she got the cleric. She had a lot of more choices, but wasn't that powerful. So that it actually
worked. More utilitarian at that point.
It actually worked. It was okay. It was much better than second edition.
It's good.
One of the main reasons that Dark Sun are never coming to fifth edition and Hasbro is that there's a lot of preparation in that game. We have a world where slavery, racism, structural caste systems and suppression of people are a key part of the setting. So if you want to release a setting like this in 2022, you have to reskin and redecorate a lot of the setting, and then the feel and the grittiness of Dark Sun might disappear. Both Jason and Jack had some points on this, and we touch on this a bit with Chris as well. So I love to dive into these social structures in games, and as a sociologist, I have to emphasize the importance that we know our players' limits and the settings' choices are in coherent with each other. So let's see what we talked about in my talks with Jack and Jason especially, but a little bit with Chris as well. When we have racism, we have some triggers for our players, so we have to figure that in a session zero and acknowledge that if we have a guy or woman playing a character, there will be some racism, and that's again in the buy-in of the first session, and the social structures with caste systems and slaves and so on are also very vivid in this setting, so that there's a lot of buy-in in the structures. And then when we looked, we lift up and see all of Athos and all of Dark Sun, we can actually see a bridge between our world and a fantasy world, right? Because if we take our world as a classic fantasy world with like Kryn, the Dragonlance setting, that's our world, and then there are people running around and say, hey, we have to stop this ecological explosion and killing, the whole planet will die, and we can stop it now if we hurry. If as a setting, then we can see why we should stop our help our own planet in the scope of a fantasy setting. If you follow me, understanding the Dragonlance setting as a
it's both my most favorite and least favorite aspects. And that is what you just said of the setting itself. I love the idea that basically your actions have the consequences. Your actions are affecting the environment, and if you want to save the world, then you need to think twice about what you're doing. I love that, but at the same time, you're right. I mean, there the elements. I mean, all the things that Dark Sun was inspired by. You know, like ancient world culture, like the Babylon and the Aztecs, John Carter, Mad Max. All of these original genres featured slavery. And the problem is between that and also just more recently and more recent years, these subjects have become more and more sensitive topics as as inequality increases, as the environment gets more aggressive, as we actually start seeing literal slavery appearing again in like world cultures, it's like this stuff's no longer funny. And the idea of indulging this stuff from in a sort of fantasy setting, you do have to approach these things lightly. What you said with the second session zero, I've seen consent forms actually start to appear now in terms of what you consider okay or not okay in an RPG game. Many years ago when I was both a DM and also as a player, I fell afoul of these things. It's like if you don't know what's okay and not okay with your players, you can cross a line. And knowing where those lines are, if you don't know, especially if you're working with players you never worked with before, it's a thing. And I would actually say this: it's a thing not to be underestimated. I've seen entire groups of players walk out on a DM before because the DM crossed a line in the campaign, and like literally the campaign just ends on the spot. And yeah, it's like maybe. Yeah, the joke about like power can easily be abused. It's like it's not a joke. It's you do need to remember that you're DMing not for yourself but for these players themselves. And so therefore, like players aren't going to want to subject themselves to entertainment, which hits them hard in their sensibilities in a bad way. You know.
Yeah, yeah, but taking ownership of the safety mechanism and the things that players and yourself as a GM won't touch in a setting, and if there are too many things you won't touch in a setting, as slavery, for example, then don't play Dark Sun. Play something else. There are so many other settings. But if you,
I'm going to have to disagree with you.
Yeah, but understand me right correctly, because if you take out slavery, it's fine. But if you also take out the racism, you also take the survival aspects in the game, because you have maybe you have some people around the table that has problem with this. So if you take too many things out of a setting that are defining the setting, you should play something another setting that are more fitted for your players.
I'm going to disagree with you because it's entirely down to how you play it, and that's the important part here. Because like I mean you can play off rather than being outright racism, you can play it off as intolerance, or you can and you can also focus on these things the same way you focus on an education. You basically have them as something that is wrong. I mean, it's like, I mean, if you're having players be hostile to each other based on sort of racist aspects or things like that, that I mean, you can encourage that in the game, but that's toxic. That's getting into the concept of player versus player. And you have to have absolute buy-in from every player if you're going to go down that route anyway. Even then, it's still absolutely toxic. The most toxic thing you can do in a campaign is have player backstabbing. But I mean, in terms of the slavery aspect, and even that, you can still include these things in an adventure and handle them the way you'd handle them in education. By okay, so this is not like sadism. I'm not trying to inflict stuff on the players. I'm giving you something which everyone agree is truly evil to struggle against. And so you guys know you're better than this. So you're fighting against something to make it better. And so in that respect, you can flip it, and then it becomes. It's almost like including the Nazis as villain trope. It's like everyone can agree on a fundamental definition, on certain fundamental definitions of evil. And so it's like if you make your villains embody some element of that fundamental definition of evil, then it's like the only thing you have to be worried about is that the adventure is going to become too pulpy.
If it goes too pulpy, why not play something else? But I acknowledge you what you're saying. It's toning down some of the more tight issues like race, as you said, as slavery, make them put them back in the story, not important parts of the story, and especially don't let the players get involved as an antagonist doing this slavery, if you can avoid that, if that is a term. If all the players are into it, that's fine. I don't care.
I heard an interesting theory from a DM the other day, saying that he set up a house rule that he just absolutely refuses to let any new player play an evil character unless he's had experience with that player before. And I thought that was a very interesting concept. And I've actually seen several DMs start picking that up. It's because one of the worst things you can do to have to undermine a campaign in general is that, again, is that PvP. And I think one of the as you correctly raised, one of the issues of Dark Sun is if you're going to go down the road of allowing certain evil things to be in abundance here, you need to make sure that the player knows how to be evil in a way that's not going to destroy the adventure and not going to destroy the party, not destroy the other players.
Yeah.
And
or the adventure is that the players are slavers, and that's the concept in the group, and all the players are into that concept. That's fine with me. Let's. But use the setting. We can use the setting in different ways. But as you said, it has to be a player buy-in. The toxicity has to be on a minimum. But I love intergroup conflicts between my players.
If it's played carefully, yes, and that's the issue.
Jason backs me up in the discussion about the grittiness and what to use in the setting, and he actually brings some interesting parallel to our own world. We talked about the races. Yes. There's a lot of races, the special races. We have the Trikeens, we have tall elves that are not Legolas, they are butt ugly. We have cannibalistic halflings, and we have half giants, and we have the mules that are a crossing between humans and dwarves.
And we have hairless dwarves. It's great.
Yeah. It's so great. So, but that's some of the races. But in the setting, there's a lot of social structures and these things. I think in this time we are in 2022, we have to convey on our players and make them okay and let them feel safe in this, because you have to play a gritty dark game in Dark Sun. You also have to buy into the racism and the social structures, because it is problematic to see slavery to be and the racial structures, the caste system there, and there can be some triggers there for sure, and I think you have to you have to embrace those and let the players understand them, and if your players are not willing to push into these structures, you can tone them down a lot. And or just say, okay, we are not playing the Dark Sun. Where do you set the limits and the borders there?
Sure. So the first thing I want to say is this is part of that session zero conversation, right? This is a critical part of that conversation. Here's the setting. To what degree, as players, are you comfortable interacting with these? Because if we're going to play in the setting, these are going to exist. But the question is, are you okay with you or one of your fellow players interacting with one of these? Let's use slavery as a for instance, because that's one of the big ones for Dark Sun, right? It's everywhere. It's iconic. The very first module, Freedom, your PCs are all slaves at the beginning of it. So you have to deal with it firsthand. From the worst point of view, right? So, would you be okay with your character being a slave? Would you be okay if, when you were defeated, your value, as far as the work that you can do, made it so that the person defeating you didn't decide to kill you, but decided to sell you into slavery? Would you be okay with one of the players in this group, possibly buying slaves and using them just like he would use any other hired men at arms? How would you feel participating in that system? And that's going to be a critical one, because everyone's going to come down on some different limits on that. And that's good, because you should have them, and those should be respected. Now, I also like to be really upfront about, why would we play in a setting like this? Right? Because that's sometimes a question that will be asked, that just to play in this setting, you must be an awful person. So,
catharsis.
Right? I mean, I'm sure you've seen some of that out there. And is it a valid question? It is. But it's a valid question that comes from a place of lacking understanding. so a quick 2 minute on that, on how I address this, because I have had it come up in my campaigns. I've run Dark Sun sessions around a single table. It was a tabletop 40K wargaming table, so quite large, 8x6. But we had 14 players around the table for that adventure. So I've done some, you know, very broad, you know, all the nerd kids from the local college scene show up and we have some fun. So I've been challenged on this a few times. Unfortunately, the typical person who's asking this question, I don't want to paint with a broad brush because, you know, everyone's unique and we all come from our unique place and have our own backgrounds. But what I see commonly coming from this question is a very first world experience that isn't really aware of everything that goes on, even around them. So I ask them if I can see their cell phone. You know, is it an Apple? Where's that made? You know where it's made. What kind of work environment is it made under? Interesting. Okay. But we own it. We buy it. We use it, right? We're communicating through computers right now, right? So some of that is possibly built into our systems as well. And yet this is a part of our society that I don't want to say it's accepted, but it's known and it's still something that's not fixed, right? We don't have Dark Sun heroes that have gone and liberated those people yet. So let's be honest for a minute, right? We live in a setting that is not that different from Dark Sun, right? We don't have the water issues. I mean, unless you live in Africa, then you very well may have the water issues. We don't have, you know, a lot of the corrupt political issues, unless you live in, you know, I would say more than half of the planet has extremely corrupt political systems, legal systems, justice systems, right? So I get that people find these things to be offensive, but these are the worlds that we live in real life. And I think, if anything, that makes Dark Sun something that should be played even more than the heroic Lord of the Rings, you know, Aragorn-style D&D, because it's real. And these are real problems, but fixing them isn't as easy as we always make it out to be, just like real life is. So that's what I would say. I would ask them their limits first, and then possibly challenge them a little bit on, you know, I don't want to see offendedness pop up in a game.
On real issues.
It's real
issues. And as you said, much more dark and gritty than any fiction. We can see the conflict in Ukraine. I'm running a Twilight 2000 game in a few weeks. And
it's dark and gritty.
Well, it's not... Yeah, it's not appropriate. No, it's pretty weird. I'm not running it in Ukraine, but wow, it's in Germany, so it's
that's appropriate.
But yeah, too close, and it's pretty weird. And we've actually talked about to cancel it. You talked about this, about the social structures, and yeah, put it into correlation with our own worlds, because it's pretty important to see why we are playing this dark fantasy version of our hobby. And I love to play dark and gritty games, as you said, and try to find the catharsis in the games to handle the greatness in this setting, and handle the real horrors in our own setting. And
that's exactly it.
Sociological horror, yep. The sociological horror effects. I love them. The racism, the social structures, the caste systems in the city states, and yeah, it's just so.
Yeah,
so uncomfortable, and it's not monsters. It's not big dragons, yep, in a dungeon. It's
you nailed
it's
it.
It's the structure. Yeah, it's systematic. Racism and systematic social structures handles and power
moves. That's right. We're the monsters.
Running this game, this Dark Sun setting, is not a normal D&D setting. Acknowledge that your players do not know everything about this setting, but the GMs I've talked to give some great perspective on how they will do it and how they will work with your players and with the setting, and give a lot of ideas to how to run a game in the Dark Sun setting. Chris, brings up some great points about heat and sand and the feelings about traveling through a desert, so he can help the players be immersive into the setting. And the setting has a lot of choices setting-wise, and for instance, the setting are dead for most cases. You need water. There's a resource game in a sub-game in the setting, and the setting is a huge desert or salt marsh. There are a few huge cities and some locals, some small settlements around. And then there's the heat and the suns that are killing everything for most cases. Can you tell us about the setting and why it's so in depth for you, and why cool details and the overview? Can you try to give us a part of this?
Well, once again, that's where, because it, in certain ways it is so alien to most people. There are a few people, you know, who have spent a fair amount of time in the desert. Of course, even then it's going to be alien to them because there are things that are different. But it is so alien to most people. That's where introducing them to, you know, showing them the book covers and stuff is so evocative. But, you know, like, everything's a little different than it, like you said, it turns everything on its head. Sky's not blue, it's olive, you know, and then, of course, depending on what's going on in the sunset, it gets crimson red. Like you said, all the races are so different. You've got, instead of, and that's another thing that I think it gets done a whole lot more now than it did when I first got into gaming, is there's a whole lot of dungeon crawl now. And I know there was a whole lot of dungeon crawl in early, like first edition, but my game is more overland. You know, there's a whole lot of overland and a whole lot of, like you said, survival. Now, once they get up a few levels and they get kind of the rhythm down, they know, okay, we need this much water. We need to make sure we're well supplied. And say they've got a wizard and he can cast Limit Secure Shelter or something like that. That's not as big a deal, although then that's going to be attacked. That's one of the things. But, you know, that getting there is 80% of the game, you know, with Dark Sun. And you're getting beat down in between while you're out on the road or you're going cross country. And it takes, that's where all the survival comes in. I mean, you can play a city campaign and still have survival elements to it. Because yeah, like the thing that I'm writing now is all about one of the cities. So, so that people can do that in depth. But it's, for me, the, for lack of a better term, the juice is out in the wilderness, you know, it's all whatever's over the next dune, you know, and like you said, I've two people who are new to the game, I've described to them that if you were in, say, a very thick stone building, a building that was made of very thick stone and was cool inside, and you walked outside, it's like opening your oven after you've preheated it, you know, you just get hit with this breath of the forge almost. A lot of people I know are inside so much, that's the only way I know how to tell them, because they haven't really experienced oppressive heat for long periods, you know. But, you know, when the daytime temperature regularly gets up to 130 degrees, there's not too many people who have experienced that. I've seen one day that it was 130 degrees when I was in Iraq. I've seen plenty of 120 degree Fahrenheit days, but...
It's a great point to specify the heat, because it's often a point, because that's a feeling. We often use music or sound effects as a GM. We often use what the players are seeing, but the feeling aspects and the smell aspects are often forgot in describing a scene and or maybe putting down into to not as important, not prioritized as it should. And especially the heat in this setting are very, very,
that's something
important
that
to emphasize constantly.
I've got a YouTube channel, so I've made videos on stuff. And one of the things that I've told people on a horror video that I was talking about was don't limit yourself to sight and sound. People have five senses. You know, like with this, you might say, even through your hair. If you don't feel it so much, but if you put your hand on it and press your hair down to your scalp, it burns. And you can feel it burning through the soles of your feet. Every time you take a step, it burns more. And your blisters feel like they're ready to explode. And every step is just, you know, just an extreme act of will to put the next foot in front of the other by the end of the day.
It's important to feel describe these, as you said, the blisters, yeah. and the tiredness
and the actual grit that's in everything, you know, that you feel it in your teeth, and your nose is full of sand. And, you know, that's one other thing. Like I said, I was in Iraq for a year
I
was part of the invasion force, and you eat sand all the time. And what was funny is after about a month of being there, any person would pick their nose in front of the prettiest girl you could find there. It wasn't embarrassing because everybody just is trying to clean that crap out of their nose all the time. Because if you don't, it gets bloody after a while. You know, you get it in your eyes, although your eyes are not that, unless it's blowing, your eyes are not that hard to keep it out of. But you know, it's in your, it gets.
No.
In between the back of your heel and your boot, and just grinds into you. It gets into the crotch of your pants, you know, where all the sand gets, and then how all the sweat is.
How do you construct a session? Because it's as a defined setting. There's a lot of course, a lot of wiggle room, but still there's a lot of things are set because the cities are written down and there's a lot of NPCs and so on. How do you navigate in this to not destroy what has been created, but still make it your own in the setting? Because that's a balance that are hard to find for some players.
When I'm planning a session, you know, I pull out my map, I pull out my monsters compendium, and I say, okay, well, what were they thinking about last session? If you're not talking about the first session is going to be a little different. If you're talking about in an ongoing campaign where you already kind of, where they've already, the players already have certain goals that they're trying to pursue,
yeah,
you know, those goals are going to take them probably in this general direction.
Yep.
So, you know, then you can kind of plan in that direction, and it's like, okay, well, what's over there? All right. If they've got to go from this city to this village, what's in between this city and this village? Well, there's a day and a half's worth of, you know, there's 3 or 4 hours worth of verdant belt. There's another day's worth of scrub plain, then some rocky badlands, then some sandy wastes. Well, then you plan out, you look and see what can be in those. Kind of go through my monster's compendium, see what really grabs me. Throw that in there. Maybe throw another couple of maybe a non-combat encounter. Kind of depends on what it is, because, you know, there's not a whole lot of people out just wandering around the wastes. Not in small groups, anyway. I mean, you might run into, like, an elf tribe or something. But in small groups, you're not going to run into too many people who aren't also adventurers wandering around the waste. And what are the chances that, especially if you're going off-road, that you're going to run into those people, you know, that you'll cross paths with them in such a large open desert? So, and then once they get there, I'll write up some NPCs. As far as my prep that I do for my tracking and stuff, I keep track of all the players, you know, all their health, and all that kind of stuff. Now they can keep track of it too. I don't discourage them from doing that, but mine is the master copy. So they don't have to worry about it. That's one of the things about my gaming style is I'm trying to get, instead of having them think about a math problem, I'm trying to make sure they're thinking about the dripping fangs of the black beast that's bearing down on them, you know. So they're in their mind's eye in the game world. So all they've got to do is look down at their die, holler out a number, and I say you hit or you miss.
There's a lot of ways to use the setting, of course, because it is a huge setting. It's a very, very big world. And you have a meta plot you try to emphasize, or do you go like session to session to find out what the players are doing?
Okay.
Or how do you...
Yeah, like we were saying before, for the most part, I do kind of session to session. I do have certain goals that I try to... certain kind of cool ideas that I come up with, and it's like, well, let's see if they'll bite at that. If they don't bite at that, they don't bite at that. And I do have their goals that they're slowly going towards. When it comes to like the Dark Sun meta plot, I'm not wild about it because, you know, like the one that was set out in the Prism Pentad series of novels that has basically been the big world-changing event there. You know, because like you get into the second half of the Obsidian Oracle, which is the fourth book in that, and the plot holes start getting pretty big. You can tell that that Troy was told, hey, we want to sell another box set here, so wrap this up, okay? But they go to find the dragon at one point. There is a major obstacle that they even mention in the book, but that is laid out in the Valley of Dust and Fire accessory. And at the end of one chapter, they're on one side of the obstacle, and at the beginning of another chapter, they're past the obstacle, just completely glossed over it. And that's not the worst of the plot holes, but because of that, I stay away from the meta plot. And if anybody's going to take out the dragon, it's going to be a PC in my game.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, but that's the difficulty with most story-bound settings, as in Star Wars. As Star Wars,
it's got to move along with the story, yeah.
Yeah, the Star Wars example, it's like the biggest story has been told, and in the Lord of the Rings world or the Tolkien world, Middle-earth, the bigger story has been told. So it's hard to play in these settings. I like the Dark Sun setting as it was intended from the beginning, and then they put some novels on top of it and some modules on top of it, and that's it's fine. It's fine. It's guidelines. It's juice. It's fluff. Yeah. But it's fine. It's not great.
Yeah. And I've never been a big fan of most of the modules either. No. I've got to say I've run three of them.
Yeah.
Because one of them I ran because my cousin got my grandmother to buy it for him for his birthday, and it's like, okay, that was your birthday present. As your birthday present from me, I will run this for you. And that was Black Flames, which is a little goofy. And I've run, I've started two groups out using a little knowledge out of the box set, and I've run Freedom once. Mm-hmm. But the rest of them I've read through, but it's like, yes. No, thank you. These are good. They're basically good for, okay, well, this is a cool place. I can cherry pick some stuff out of them, but that's about what they're good for. I feel the same way about most of the stuff that's out of the revised box set and forward. It's kind of like, well, I've got this for completeness, you know, so I can say I've got the whole set and it's got this cool thing and it's got this cool thing, but like everything from here to here, I'm not going to worry about that too much. I'll just ignore that.
No. You know? Jax talks about the genre and the moods in the Dark Sun setting to give some perspective on how to run a game.
It's interesting you hit on that, actually. That they actually set out a charter as what they consider to be like the core tenets or elements of Dark Sun as such. I don't remember the exact list, but the things it included is that you're dealing with magic as environmental devastation, at the use of magic as a price. You're dealing with all of the traditional Tolkien-esque races have been subverted. So, like, halflings are not cute, innocent children. They're actually arrogant cannibals. Elves are lean, mean, hungry thieves. Humans are racist monsters, and dwarves are suffering from a case of OCD that's so bad they'll actually rise from the dead to keep it going. One could easily mistake gritty fantasy for grimdark. Maybe a way to sort of characterize it. Do you remember the movie Excalibur from the 70s?
That
would be an example of gritty fantasy. There was a whole genre of that happened right around the time of Empire Strikes Back when it was originally released. And I'm showing my age here. But gritty fantasy. In some ways, people consider that to be what killed the fantasy genre in the first place. And because you had like Hawk the Slayer with this low budgetness, but, you know, campy fun. And you had Lady Hawk similarly. I mean, a little bit tragic, but a little bit edgy, but still romantic. But then like movies like Excalibur came out and other fantasy movies like that, which were just low budget and just miserable slogs. The same thing happened in science fiction as well. Like for every for every fun ice pirates they tried to make, there would be several like miserable, worthy, dark, grim, just miserable slog movies that just killed fantasy and sci-fi for about 10 years. You couldn't get a script through Hollywood until the mid late 90s. It wasn't until literally The Lord of the Rings, when it was released in the late 90s, early 90s, that we actually started seeing a return to fantasy again, a big budget fantasy. I mean,
Willow was one of them. Willow
was a straight exception, and I think the reason why Willow happened is because Steven Spielberg and George Lucas, after just finishing Return of the Jedi, they could do literally anything they want, and that was their next movie. and it was wonderful for what it was. It was actually a positive, uplifting, family friendly fantasy, which was absolutely unheard of. Weirdly enough, that was a genre of one for decades until literally the Lord of the Rings came out, which is wild to think. But now, separating that from Grimdark was almost kind of an invention of Alan Moore with Watchmen. I would say like the first properly grimdark movie. And then that became its own genre in and of itself. It started with superheroes, then it got passed on to other things. And it's been even separating that from urban fantasy. I mean, urban fantasy including things like World of Darkness or Twilight. That still falls within urban fantasy. All of those end up being different genres. They all have different kind of feels to them. And it is possible to mix as such. But even then, all three, not a single one of those really fits in with the Dark Sun. It has more in common with Mad Max and Conan the Barbarian than it does with any of those other genres, and that's kind of what I liked about it, because it was kind of an antidote to the traditional Tolkien-esque, like elves in the forest, slaying dragons fantasy. Is that like what happens when the earth is ruined by genocidal madmen?
That's a great point.
And we end up going back to the Stone Age. There's elements of some of those, like, you know, like 40,000 BC. There's elements of some of those old sci-fi pulp novels. Troy Denny himself said he was inspired by John Carter. That novel series is what actually the Barsoom novel series is what inspired him to actually make Dark Sun in the first place. And then they combine it with a slight gothy edge from Brahm's art, because literally Brahm would actually draw things, and then Troy and his colleague would actually come up with monsters and adventures based upon these photos or these paintings. And yeah, it is very much its own take on, as you say, it's sword and sandals, but it's almost a post-apocalyptic sword and sandals, which is what's so appealed to it about me. Between that and fact, I grew up in a desert, so I actually know what that terrain looks like from personal experience.
The world lost their way and didn't manage to survive, and we have the bad guys in this setting are the defilers for so many reasons. But in the setting, we have some, we will not survive as humans and different races, and the Trikeen will subvert us for sure, and so on. But when we look at the setting, it's, as you said, it's a fantasy world that have lost their way, and they were done. It's not functioning anymore.
And that just says you can take that in many directions. I mean, you mentioned about sandbox versus railroad, and I've actually played in both types of campaigns recently. I played a sandbox campaign, and I played a full railroad campaign, and I agree that actually, I think one of the most fundamental aspects that people that you need to remember is that if so many DMs, it's easy to forget that it's the player's game, not yours. Yes, you're creating the world around them, but if you aren't taking into account the character's, the player's desires, then the player will go off and do rebellious little things. If you want the player to be invested into to where you want them to go, you need to give them a reason to be invested. It's not enough to say, "Oh, you're going to be paid money to save the princess." It's like, there needs to be a more compelling reason to save the princess. I mean, like something that appeals to that particular player. Like there's a reason for them to fight. For example, like say that you've actually, I just once said this in the campaign, like One of the reasons why I actually managed to get the players, you know, to go down this whatever it was of this railroad, was they were raised in a convent, in an orphanage, and the sisters that raised them were actually who had actually been protecting them against the death squads that were traveling through the land. This was dark fantasy, obviously. Very, very dark fantasy. But the sisters that raised them were under threat themselves. And I had some of the early encounters in the game was of them being protected by the sisters. And so the players responded in kind, and actually the players got quite protective of these fabricated parental figures. So things like that, or they discover a person and this is what needs to happen in order to save this person they've come to care about, or this is what needs to happen. So yeah, giving them a reason to invest in the story actually makes a big, big difference in terms of, and also when they succeed, you will actually get that feeling of triumph from the players, and that kind of makes it all worth it. Yeah. It's much more like, I mean, it has more in common, I mean, mad as it sounds, it has more in common with Twilight 2000.
Yes, oh yes, I'm actually running a game next weekend and first time for this, so I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, and so if played right, I mean, that kind of tragedy, it's a difference between someone exploring darkness and kind of wallowing in darkness and someone in the face of darkness finding bright sparks of humanity.
Yeah, it's like Walking Dead or something like that instead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or like the most recent Mad Max.
Yeah, yeah. So. But a mood in a setting like in, as you said, in Dark Sun, it's... you have to the players have to have a buy-in that this is not Toon, this is not Forgotten Realms, this is not
yeah, exactly, it's hard mode, it's not enough to actually just find ways to triumph, to find ways to achieve like romantic victory. You have to survive first before you can achieve that victory. You have to claw for the survival first. And as you get the buy-in from that, and you can bring in the music, which actually makes it feel like an alien, slightly hostile world. And you can bring in the feeling with that. Now, you can't force a silly player into a tense moment. I mean, if a player wants to be silly, you have to actually give that space. And I think that's what so many people who try to do serious campaigns get wrong. You can't force someone not to be silly. If you try and do it, it's going to backfire spectacularly. If that makes sense. So it's like if they're on board and they're involved in it, you'll never have to worry about forcing seriousness because it will force itself.
Yeah, but then we're back to the session zero and expectation from the players and not try not to crack jokes. And every time the mood are tense, I often use when I'm playing to have different, as you said, the different soundtracks. And when I'm just running my normal ambient, they can go in whatever direction they want. They can crack jokes, they can make comments, they can go more dark if they want or something like that. But when I've set on some specific ambience, then the players has to focus, so because there will come a tense situation or something from me as a GM. And then I hope the players will
You've
buy
got boss music.
Yeah, boss music is a good word for it, but it's not only for combat or anything like that, but also in when I'm explaining a horrific house or something like that, so the players not are cracking jokes about some Netflix series they just saw and putting a pop culture reference into the game. I don't care if they do it in some parts of the game, but some of the games some of the scenes are built up to be tense or important for the story, and then I want to focus from my players to know that this is serious. Now we are in game, if you're playing a funny character, always your coping mechanism as a character is to crack a joke, that's so fine, it's so cool, but try to be 100% in game when my boss ambient the music, as you call it, came on. It's my tool to guide the players in a certain mood.
No, I hear you on that, and I'm a big believer in music for mood and environment control.
Jason underlines the facts that the grittiness and the darkness and the sand and saddle feeling in the Dark Sun setting are so important to bring forward to the table. what are the most important things for you when you're setting up a gritty fantasy game? Let's target on Dark Sun, but in general, the grittiness in fantasy. How do you put up these things so your players know this stuff? And as you said, putting in hard mode.
Okay, so a few things. If you have players that aren't used to the setting, having a intro session where they may not be playing their planned PCs, but they're just playing as maybe some pre-made NPC-powered individuals in Dark Sun, just to experience the world. And it may not be anything super high fantasy, just maybe life in a city-state, or maybe life in one of the wilderness towns or tribes or whatnot, just to give them an idea. So okay, like I need to pay attention to how much gear I can carry. Water weighs 8 pounds per gallon, and I need to down a gallon a day unless I stay in the shade and don't do a lot of work during that day. So, like, if we're going to go on a 3-day journey, that's 24 pounds. And now I'm looking at my character. I'm saying, I'm not a super strong guy. Like, I've got some muscles, but yeah, hauling around 24 pounds, in addition to anything else I want to have, like maybe a bone longsword would be nice. That's heavy. That's a big deal. And that's not even food. That's just my water requirement. So having a almost like a, intro game to the setting can be extremely helpful, especially in any setting that is distinctly different than what your players have experienced. So for most people, if you're playing D&D or you've played it before, you've played any RPG before, you can sit down in a Forgotten Realms setting or play a Lord of the Rings or play a Marvel superheroes game and know, okay, I know what a shield agent is. I'm pretty sure I understand how this works. Dark Sun's going to be a lot different than that. Anything gritty and realistic is going to be different. So enforcing things like encumbrance, keeping track of timekeeping is, I find, critically important. Keeping track of the group's ability to move, right? So if you have, you're doing a wilderness campaign and you've got two elves, so they've got that increased long-legged elven movement speed. And then you've got a human, but he's a barbarian, so he gets that little movement boost, so he's able to keep up with the elves. And then you've got a dwarf. Like, you're just not moving fast. The party's only going to go as fast as that little, stumpy guy in the back is going. That's a big part of it. The other one is going to be, this borders on a pet peeve of mine, a PC and character death. Okay, so so every game has a mechanic for it. So how do you handle it? And what I've found with a majority of folks that are maybe newer to role playing, they don't like killing their friends, which I can understand, right? That's that doesn't seem like something a friend would do. Right, kill your character that you spent, an hour or two building. You've spent years maybe in a campaign. You've got a lot invested in this character. That's a hard thing to kill. So here's my problem. Let's say you're sitting around a table and you're one of my players, right? And there are three other people around the table. And all of my dice as a DM are rolled openly. That's just a personal rule, right? We have agreed to playing this using this system. The system says roll dice. It doesn't say the DM makes the decision for everything. It says roll dice. So if it says roll dice, I'm going to roll dice. If the dice say, something happens, well, that's what the dice say. I'm not in control of that. I'm the DM. I do planning. But if it's a dice roll, it's a dice roll. So a lot of times PC death comes down to a dice roll. So you've made your decisions. We're in the middle of a combat. And you see the following happen. One of your other players has made a decision to hold the gap. It wasn't the best decision. He rolls terribly, doesn't do well. I'm like, all right, well, he's got a big bad guy on him, or he's surrounded by three little guys that aren't really powerful, but there's three of them. I drop three dice, and sure enough, One of them pops up, a critical hit. We follow it through, and you see me kind of waiting a little bit and not really giving the information, or I start maybe hiding my dice and rolling things, and I'm like, all right, well, he brought you down to -8 hit points. You're not dead, but you're bleeding out. The encounter ends, and, you know, someone was able to get to him and give him a heal real quick so the character doesn't pass away. All right, fast forward a couple of sessions. Again, it's a surprise encounter. Now it's you. It's your turn, and you're in a bad spot. All the rest of the party is asleep. You are on guard duty. You're fending off this Belgoi single-handed, and you've made your will save, so he hasn't dominated you, but this thing's got terrible claws, and he's clawing into your character. You're not wearing your armor because you were, I don't know, lazy or asleep. Who knows? But whatever it comes down to, we're rolling the dice, and the dice roll, and I look at the dice, I say, yeah, and that brings you a -12. You're dead. Somewhere in your mind, you're going to be like, hey, wait a second. Remember, like, 3 sessions ago? Like, shouldn't have Dave died when he was surrounded by those 3 little tarry rat things? And, like, you know, you only brought him to -8. The dice were pretty clear. That was a crit. I'm pretty sure he didn't roll all ones, right? He should be dead. So why am I dead this time? If Dave didn't die last time, why do I die this time? Well, that's not fair. And that's really what it comes down to is with PC death, we have to take our hands off the dice as DMs. Because the moment you start interacting and trying to push results one way or another, and this includes DMs, your favorite NPCs, right? Your storytelling, you've got an arc that you're hoping the PCs walk down. Well, maybe, you know what? Maybe that arc's not going to work out. Just like maybe Dave's PC isn't going to work out. The dice didn't go that way. PCs aren't going to walk in that direction. You did some preparation, and that's great, but that arc's not going to happen. You have to say goodbye to that planning as a DM, just as much as you're expecting your PCs to be willing to let go of their characters. And here's the key to gritty and realism. If there's not the very real possibility of death, it's not gritty, and it's not, you know, it's not horror. It's not gritty. It's not dangerous. There's no fear. And if they know that the DM is going to just keep them alive, you're going to have an interactive storytelling experience, but it's not going to be a gritty one, because they're not really afraid of dying. You've taken away that illusion because you say, yes, even though we have this mechanic that we've agreed to, I'm not willing to let your PC die. And that's just that horror has to have a very real possibility of death. And nothing underlines that better than a PC death. So I'll be honest, you DMs out there, if you're DMing Dark Sun and it's your first session for your players, I am not saying go over and above. Do not make it any harder than the setting already is. And 3.5 is really good about having the challenge rating system, and only 1 out of 20 encounters should be like a boss fight challenge rating. That's 4 CR higher than the party level. Most of your encounters are going to be right around CR. So in that, though, I'm sure some of your players are going to make bad calls in combat. Kill them. Kill a PC. Kill 3. Kill a whole party. Nothing's going to say, hey, this world is dangerous, like death, right? It is the underlining of the word survival that you really can't do with too much else. But again, just like I said earlier, you can't push it. You can't force it on them, because that's just as unfair as keeping them alive.
It's a great point to let the players see the dice rolling, because I'm not a fan of DM screens and so on, because it's disconnect me from my players.
Me neither.
And as you said, the dice are part of the rules or the setting or the agreement we right. Sit on and see that there are no cheats, there are no fumbles, and there are crits and so on, and it's fine. And if you lose your favorite NPC, super bad guy in a flurry of fumbles because he's an idiot with his sword, it's then that happens, and that's fine. That's also a story, and also bring us And again, if you kill players,
right,
you kill characters, not players, because you need the players. don't kill your players, that's illegal. When you kill your the characters... Or,
yes, don't kill your players.
That's also a story, and one of the things I've really learned about playing the Alien RPG is that players can play a lot of characters through a campaign, and the Alien campaign system are set like... it's you as a player that experienced the arc mm-hmm. of the story, the meta plots, the journey of Ripley, whatever, or the story in so many parts. It's not your role, because your role or your character has died numerous mm-hmm. times in this story. Aliens have learned me as a GM that it's okay to kill characters, and it's not a problem. Some players has very difficulty with this and will be very offended when you're off the characters, especially as you do, that you want to let your players create your characters from the ground up and with background stories and so on. It's a lot of work for players, and for us as grown-ups, we don't have as much time as we should have in for this hobby. So it's hard to lose mm-hmm. a character for sure. I'm always GM, so I lose a lot of characters of all my favorite NPCs. But yeah.
Right, we lose all our characters. It's not fair.
They always die.
They always die.
When you look at the Dark Sun setting, and why is the hero's journey in Dark Sun so difficult and to convey in Dungeons & Dragons, especially because Dungeons & Dragons is very heroic. The characters has a lot of skills and a lot of feats, and it's fifth edition. It's That's almost right. impossible to kill a character because they have death saves and so on. It's for sure. It's,
challenge accepted.
Yeah, but again, you have to, as you said, you are rolling your dice openly, but you can set the challenge rating higher for sure. But in the system's parameters, the characters are very powerful, so you have to set up the expectation for the players. How do you create this this vacuum so the players are feeling a great story but still not getting trumbled?
I would say Dark Sun lends itself to that power vacuum better than any other D&D setting out there, and I've played them all, so I come with that that background. So remember, in Dark Sun there's a lot of authority figures. There's not a lot of good guys, okay? So if you're in the most built-up, quote-unquote, I'm going to use the word civilized, because nothing in Dark Sun really is civilized. If you're going into the most urban area of Dark Sun, you're dealing with some pretty bad people, right? And the only way that urban area survives is because of the institution of slavery. And you can't pull that punch. If you free all of the slaves, you create massive economic problems for everyone in that city-state. And Dark Sun was really good about doing this in the 1990s with the Freedom module was the first Dark Sun module, and it covered the death of the Sorcerer Monarch of Tyr. And there are several more modules. The Road to Uruk would be next, that detail the economic, the political, the societal collapse that happens when you try to force these good guys into a leadership role and do all of the iconic things that good guys do, like freeing slaves, which we would all agree is a universal good, and slavery should be seen as a universal evil. That should be seen as that, but you should also see it as the economic foundation for a society. That doesn't make it a good thing, and it certainly doesn't make it an acceptable thing, but the more good your PCs try to do in Dark Sun, the more problems they're creating, not just for themselves, but for everyone around them, which is going to be great because NPCs that, you know, used to be friendly to your PCs are now having to deal with the fact that you're bringing devastation upon them and their families, and they're not going to be so friendly to you anymore in all likelihood. So with every step that the PCs make that you would see in a positive light, like a good guy kind of step, you need to, as a dungeon master, have a decent head on your shoulders for how societies are built, how economics work, right? That supply-demand equation, so that you can take every victory and turn it into a Pyrrhic victory, right? So a victory that really doesn't feel like a win because the consequences and the fallout from your success brought about possibly unperceived problems or evil for both the PCs and their allies. So Dark Sun, again, mid-1990s, they're dropping some pretty heavy stuff that, you know, a lot of us were getting into as teenagers and maybe preteens and young adults. You know, a lot of us weren't really thinking about things like this at that age. We were thinking like, you know, Aragorn from Lord of the Rings, right? And we're thinking about our classic iconic heroes and King Arthur, right? We're going to be the good guys. And, you know, all of a sudden we're looking at the consequences of our good guy actions. And we're like, wow, like we have some problems that we have to deal with now. There was some fallout from what we did that we didn't really see coming. So Dark Sun DMs, Pyrrhic victories. Make sure you've got something lined up. And a lot of it should be pretty common sense. Because again, the world is starving. Listen, if everyone's starving and you somehow get like 100 loaves of bread, you're not the good guy in that situation. Mm-hmm. You're a bad guy. You're a bread hoarder, right? You have what people need to live, and you're spending it on like a magic, you know, bracelet or something stupid, right? You're the typical behavior of D&D player characters
when
in
Dark
Sun.
When we look at the Dark Sun setting, to make you as you said, it's hard to create the hero stuff, and the that's one of the golden things about this setting. I love the gray areas in the setting. And there are no good guys and no bad guys. There are some more bad guys than good guys, but there are not some. There's not black and white in this setting, and that's the reason I love this setting so much. And because the mm-hmm. Sorcerer Kings, yeah, from the outside they are bad guys, but if you defeat those, right, what happens to the structure of the city and the chaos and so on? So. A lot of moral and ethical problems will convey on the players and try to figure out how to do this. And I love this to figure out how to bring the players into these hard choices. That's the Dark Sun world is just so great to create this tension.
Absolutely,
for sure.
Couldn't agree more.
Because I really hate the mech fantasy worlds like Forgotten Realms and Dragonlance and so on. It's fun.
Yeah.
And it's great to, yeah.
Like they're sugary sweet.
Yeah.
Too much goodness.
Too many funny sidekick races and too many. Oh, it's getting so dull.
Uh-huh.
It's fine for Friday night and drink some beers, but if I want to play some,
I guess. I can barely stomach a lot of it. I think for most of the people that I game with, we're as bad as 3-5 can be. I think we're going to just stick with that setting for now. Fourth was abysmal. We got into fifth a little bit. I get why it's popular, but I've spoiled my people. So they try to do character creation in fifth, and they're like, oh my gosh, I don't want to play a furry. And what I do want to play, the rules tell me I can't play. Let's just stick with 3-5. So I was like, all right, we'll do that.
This last segment is my ideas and Chris' idea about the Dark Sun setting and where to go from here. As I said in the beginning, I will try to convert the Dark Sun setting into the Forbidden Lands system from Free League, because I'm a Free League fanboy, but also because I feel like that system can do some pretty cool things for the setting as a whole. Chris has some short ideas about the future of what he wants to see from other developers, and as he conveys that he are about to finish a book about Dark Suns. What do you want from the setting going forward? If you could take some choices in the setting, how would you set up some choices in the setting?
Well, you mean like if there were ever new products going forward? Yeah.
Well, for example, I am actually
working on a product right now called the City State of Baelic. That's going to be free, of course, because I don't own the copyright, so it's just going to be given to the community for free. But I would like to see it continue using like pre-revised box set feel, although you still have to consider the stuff in post-box set when you're doing your research as canon. But something that is well-researched, because that's been the problem with a lot of the stuff that I've seen since then, and I don't want to pick anyone out and say, oh, they did a terrible job on this, because not all of it was necessarily terrible, but a lot of it seems like, oh, well, you took a whole lot of liberties and really took the world in a different direction that completely ignored about 40% of the canon, you know? It's like, it's fine to go ahead and push the world forward, but let's go ahead and do it where it still works with the, you know, where you've done your research and it still works with the prior canon. And that's what I'm trying to do with this. I've spent a few months. That's one of the reasons I picked Baelic, was when you looked at everything, excluding all the stuff that was copy pasted, the same stuff in two different books. Baelic only had about 7 pages worth of canon outside of the one of the novels, you know, outside of the Obsidian Oracle. So it was like, okay, there's a good place to start. I don't have that much that I've got to research on it other than just knowing the world stuff. And I can take it from there. So when it's done, it's going to be, I'm thinking, 120 to 150 pages. I've already got about 60 pages of it done. But it's going to be, and I already did a player's guide to Baelic, because that's something I was thinking about, was, you know, in second edition, about 95% of the product was aimed at the DM. The DM was the primary customer, and that's one of the things that they have continued to try to do more and more of with Wizards of the Coast, as they realized, well, hey, let's sell to the whole party. You know, we can sell more books that way. But because of that, there's a lot of places, like, for instance, with the City-State of Baelic, which is a loosely based on kind of Greco-Roman feel. If somebody says they're from Baelic, other than just saying they're from it and kind of maybe having a familiarity with the Greco-Roman world there, what do they know about it? You know, what can they say about it? So for that, I set out to say, okay, here are some street gangs. Here are the big, you know, all the big public buildings. Here are a few of the businesses. Here, you know, here's a few of the things. Here's a map of the city that doesn't have all the details already out. None of the stats or anything were in that. It was basically, and if you are a whatever class, here's where you might have learned your trade. You know, here's how you might have learned as a fighter to become a fighter. Here's how you might have learned as a cleric or whatever, you know, as a bard. And so I put that out there. And now for the DM, I'm doing the, here's where all the detail is. Here's where a bunch of NPCs and their stats are. Here's where new monsters and new magic items, a whole bunch of maps for buildings and stuff.
And plot hooks.
You said, there's going to be, I haven't got to that yet, but yeah, there's going to be stuff where it's, here's 10 different hooks you can use to get your campaign started in, in Balak, that kind of thing. But I would love to, I'd love to see more of that. Now, there was a fella, I'm blanking on his last name. His first name is June. So in that, it's kind of, it's very player, it's something that any DM could hand to their player and not have to worry about them, knowledge that might force them to try hard not to metagame, you know, that kind of thing. But his has 70, 80, maybe 100 different locations in it. You know, it's got a bunch of inns, a bunch of temples, a bunch of shops and stuff like that in it. So it's, his is actually well done. He didn't do, because he doesn't... because he doesn't have stats, it's not necessarily edition specific either. The only thing in it that's a little bit edition specific is he has it set about, I want to say 30 or 40 years after the events in the original box set. You know, like 30 or 40 years after Kalak died.
Yeah, so you get some, like a buffer for him to tell stories. And,
yeah,
and that's,
yeah.
That's a good
but
choice.
Most everything in there you could use pre Kalak's death too, if you wanted.
So you like, so you like some more setting stuff, more detailed setting stuff for creating them.
Because that's where I think pretty much any good DM is going to grab. Okay, that's a cool little detail over here. I can do something using that detail that my players would really like. You know. That's any little details are where it's at when it comes to, you never know what's going to grab somebody and say, oh yeah, I've got a player who's really into this, and that's really going to rock their world if they get to do something with that.
Yeah, they did that, so. With the El Kadim setting. If you ever read that, I played a lot of the El Kadim setting, another setting that.
Yeah. I didn't get to play it, but yeah, I know what you're talking about.
In another setting that will never be re-released by appropriation terms. But they actually did that. Create a booklet for each of the cities where it was two parts, when there was a player edition, and then was the dark secrets and the evil NPCs and the plot hooks and so on. So I like that a lot. And some of the bigger cities, they actually made a box set for. And so there was maps and so on, and that was pretty good at those things back in the day. So that's for sure.
Yeah, unfortunately, they didn't put out a huge amount for El Kadim. It only got like what, 6 or 7 releases for it.
I think something like that.
It got a couple of box sets and a few splat books.
Yeah, I had a lot of it. I only have the core book now, actually, in my shelf here. It's the only thing I have left after my purge of D&D books back in the zeros.
That's one thing about that you got to say about second edition is, unless you're talking about something sci-fi or something modern, if you wanted it, second edition had it probably.
Yeah, for sure.
With 12 to 18, depending on how you count them. Campaign settings, and there was a little something for everybody there.
Yeah, I also like the Ravenloft setting up, a lot of Ravenloft as well. Finally, I want to thank the three guys that I talked to about Dark Sun, and as I said, I will work on the Forbidden Lands conversion for Dark Sun and for Athos. It's a open source both for the system, but for Dark Sun, we cannot release it and earn any money for it, but I love the setting and I want a great system for this setting. So if you have any ideas about working with me or bring out some ideas for the Free League Engine Zero rules, reach out to me. We can talk about these things openly. I'm not a big system guy, so I just want to find the right system for the right setting. I don't like crunchy systems. I don't like a lot of nitty-gritty things in a system. I love the accurate, easy narrative system that Free League have provided for us at the Forbidden Land, but still has a nice, easy resource system, and adventures in Athos will be much easier with D6s than D20s. That's my point of view. No. Thanks for this time. Thanks for listening. And next time we will touch on the very popular 5e module, Curse of Strahd, and talk to Katie about how she runs this and have run it several times, and why this is a great module for both experienced GMs, but also more newbie GMs in the role-playing world. Again, thanks to Chris, Jason, and Jack for give us their insight on Dark Sun and Athos, so we all can be better GMs in this sandy and very brutal world. Follow us on Facebook, GM Workshop, the podcast. If you want to interact with us and talk to us, give us a message.